Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us this afternoon at the Federalist Society's presentation on the FCC's authority to promulgate internet traffic rules. The focus of today's panel is the FCC's authority to promulgate net neutrality rules. As you may recall, on October 22, 2009, the commission issued its notice of proposed rulemaking in its Preserving the Open Internet proceeding. The NPRM, in short, suggests moving forward beyond the Commission's 2005 Internet Policy Statement and codifying those four principles, as well as adding two new ones, the first dealing with non-discrimination and the second dealing with transparency and disclosure of practices by Internet service providers. Comments on the NPRM were due in January, and reply comments are due this Friday, March 5th, so this is a very timely debate. We have three great panelists to discuss these issues. First, we're here from Greg Garr, former Solicitor General of the United States and now a partner at Latham & Watkins. He recently wrote the paper that is the topic of our conversation today, the FCC's Internet Power Surge, the Constitutional and Statutory Limits on the FCC's Authority to Promulgate Net Neutrality Rules. So Greg's going to lead off. Then we'll hear from Gigi Sohn, the president and co-founder of Public Knowledge and one of the most fearless and effective public interest advocates around. And then Helgi will respond. She's a partner at Wiley Ryan and the author of the lead brief in the Comcast BitTorrent case, a former colleague of mine at the FCC and one of the greatest legal talents that I know. So we're very excited to have Helgi along as well. And then Gigi will close us off with the affirmative cases after Helgi's discussion, and then we'll open it up to some questions from the audience as well. So be drafting those as we proceed through the discussion this afternoon. So with that, I'll turn it over to Greg.
Thank you all for coming here this afternoon. Thanks for the Federal Society for hosting this. Thanks especially to Gigi and Helgi for agreeing to come here and talk about my paper. By virtue of having done that, I think they may be the only people in the room and maybe in D.C. who have actually read it, so I appreciate their slogging through it. Also wanted to thank a couple of people who helped me work on the paper, my partner Matt Brill and associate Bill Renner, who did a lot of work on the paper. So the subject of the paper is whether or not the FCC has authority to regulate broadband internet access, and you could think of it in terms of whether or not the FCC has the authority to treat internet service providers like telephone companies. And in 2009, the FCC issued a notice of proposed rulemaking that concluded that it did have authority in this realm and purported to announce certain non-discrimination principles that it wishes to apply to internet traffic. Those principles are subject to a lot of policy debate, important policy debate, which really is beyond the subject of my discussion. What we looked at was the FCC's authority to regulate in this area at all. And when we looked at that, we concluded that the FCC lacks authority. And we started with first principles. And certainly when you live in D.C. and most people think that administrative agencies can do whatever they want, and usually they do what they want. But in fact, administrative agencies are, of course, creatures of statutes. We have a constitution that places the lawmaking power in the Congress, and it's well settled, of course, that administrative agencies can only exercise jurisdiction and authority that Congress gives it. So the first place you would have to look is what Congress has given the agencies. And importantly, the courts are generally skeptical of agency efforts to expand their authority into new areas. Supreme Court said about a decade or so ago, an agency has no power to correct flaws that it perceives in the statute it is empowered to administer by extending its rulemaking power beyond the boundaries set by Congress. So what boundaries has Congress set for the FCC? Congress has passed a couple of statutes. Its organic statute, passed in 1934, sets very broad, gives the FCC very broad authority over wire and radio communications. But, of course, no specific authority over the Internet, since it's not surprising that Congress in 1934 had no idea what the Internet was, so it, of course, didn't give the FCC authority over that. Congress amended the statute in important respects in 1996, which is closer in time, although really before the true advent of the internet as we know it, and it didn't address it there. What Congress did say in 1996 is important, though. It gave the FCC the authority to regulate telecommunication carriers, but not internet information service providers as common carriers under the Telecommunications Act. And importantly, after the 1996 Act, the FCC looked at internet service providers and determined that they should be treated as information service providers and not telecommunications carriers, which meant that they were not subject to regulation as common carriers. And that's important for reasons I'll explain a little bit later. The FCC fought that interpretation all the way to the Supreme Court and prevailed in a case called Brand X. Now, there have been many in Congress who have proposed that Congress give the FCC explicit authority to regulate broadband internet service. Those efforts have not failed. Have not succeeded. They've failed. The FCC doesn't have any explicit authority that it can point to. But it does have something that the courts have created called the ancillary jurisdiction doctrine, which it can point to and has pointed to as a source of its authority. That doctrine ultimately is rooted in the statutory authority that Congress has given the FCC, but expands it, at least at the margins, to give the FCC slightly broader authority than expressly delegated by Congress. And there are two components to the doctrine. First, the courts look to whether or not the regulation that the FCC is propounded is within the scope of the agency's general grant of authority under Title I over radio and wire communications. That's a really broad grant of authority, and most things do fall within the subject matter of Title I, at least as concerns radio and wire communications. And the internet, it's not really disputed in this area, does do that. The second factor is really sort of where the action is in these cases. And it's whether or not the regulation is reasonably ancillary to the performance of the FCC's statutorily mandated responsibilities. So it's statutorily mandated responsibilities that the FCC has to point to. Ancillary jurisdiction is a pretty good thing if you're an agency because it does expand power beyond the express delegations. It's what the D.C. Circuit has called, aptly, I think, an amorphous jurisdiction doctrine. And because of its amorphous nature, the D.C. Circuit has cautioned that it has to be applied carefully, that the agency can't resort to the ancillary jurisdiction doctrine to give it boundless authority that it can't exercise under our separation of powers. So how does the FCC fare under the ancillary jurisdiction doctrine? And that gets us back to the notice of proposed rulemaking that the FCC passed in 2009 concerning internet access. The notice of proposed rulemaking is about a 100-page document. And if you look at the document, you'll find that about a page of it actually addresses the FCC's authority to embark on this broad new regulatory regime of regulating internet access. And there are three provisions of the Communications Act that the FCC ultimately points to. The first two are Section 230B and 706A. They amount to policy statements by Congress about the internet, in particular policy statements concerning efforts to avoid excessive regulation of the internet. And I think that there are two problems with those policy statements as a basis for ancillary jurisdiction that the FCC is exercising. The first is a policy statement is almost by definition not a statutorily mandated responsibility. It's not a mandate, it's a policy statement. Congress passes lots of policy statements, it's sort of general principles that it thinks is are good ideas for agencies or others to pursue, but they are not statutory mandates. Congress knows how to pass a statutory mandate when it wants to, and when it doesn't put it in a policy statement. So that's a problem under the second prong of the ancillary jurisdiction doctrine. The other problem for the FCC is that the content of the policy statements is to promote the, quote, unfettered access to the internet, unfettered by federal and state regulation. That's explicitly what Congress said. So it's a little bit of an odd thing for the FCC to be pointing to these statutory policy statements as a basis for regulating the internet when the policy that Congress was expressing in these provisions, at least, was to continue with lack of regulation, unfettered access, access unfettered by federal or state regulation. So I think for those two reasons, I think that these two statutory provisions are a unsound basis for ancillary jurisdiction. The other provision that the FCC cited to in its notice of proposed rulemaking is Section 201B of the Communications Act. That section is the general, grants the FCC general rulemaking authority under Title I of the statute. And I think this is no doubt broad rulemaking authority expressed in very broad terms. But as a basis for ancillary jurisdiction, I think there are two problems with this provision. The first is that the Supreme Court has made very clear that agencies cannot fall back on their general rulemaking provisions to expand their powers into new areas. It's sort of an anti-bootstrapping principle. If agencies could do that, then simply by virtue of Congress passing a broad rulemaking provision, which it typically does for agencies, agencies could sort of exercise authority over anything they like and sort of continuously expand their authority. The Supreme Court, in a case called Dimension Financial, rejected that approach and said, no, you've got to do better in terms of identifying a source of statutory authority. The general rulemaking provision itself won't do. The second problem with Section 201B is that the FCC's authority is that it concerns the FCC's authority over common carriers. It's general rulemaking authority over common carriers. Why is that a problem for the FCC? It's a problem because the FCC, as I mentioned before, has gone out of its way to define internet access, internet service providers as information service providers and not telecommunications carriers that are subject to common carrier regulation. So again, given that FCC interpretation, it's a very odd thing for the agency to be relying on section the rulemaking authority in Section 201B to regulate internet service providers, which are, according to the FCC today, information service providers. There's a couple more general problems, I think, with the FCC's exercise of ancillary jurisdiction here. The first is that the general notion of passing internet traffic rules is inconsistent with other parts of the statute. The statute explicitly says that the FCC's Organic Act, 1996 Act, explicitly says that the FCC cannot treat entities that are not common carriers like common carriers. And again, this gets back to the FCC's prior interpretation that internet service providers are not to be treated like common carriers. So under the terms of the statute, the FCC shouldn't be treating them like common carriers. And that inconsistency with other provisions of the statute is something that the Supreme Court and the D.C. Circuit have pointed to in other cases in which they found the lack of ancillary jurisdiction, And then more generally, I think the problem with the FCC's exercise of ancillary jurisdiction here or attempted exercise of ancillary jurisdiction is that it would, in effect, amount to a boundless conception of jurisdiction, the very thing that the FCC cannot do under our separations of power, because if these statutory provisions that I've talked about are sufficient to support the exercise of ancillary jurisdiction, then surely almost any statutory provision would be sufficient. And the Supreme Court, and in particular the D.C. Circuit, has said that ancillary jurisdiction does not exist to give an agency unbounded authority. So what does the FCC do? What can it do if it doesn't have ancillary jurisdiction over these provisions? The obvious thing that it can do is it can go back to the source of the authority and ask for authority, and that's, of course, Congress. The FCC could go back to Congress and say, pass a law giving us explicit authority over the regulation of the internet. The FCC has not done that, at least recently, as far as I'm aware. One of the reasons why it may not see that as an attractive option is that, as I mentioned, Congress has considered bills explicitly giving the FCC authority over the internet and has not enacted those bills. So the FCC may not see that as a viable legislative option. It does seem to me, though, that it would be appropriate for the FCC to go to Congress This isn't some minor regulatory issue that we're talking about. The FCC itself has described the internet as something that has, quote, transformed our nation's economy, culture, and democracy. It seems that something that important, and we all know how important the internet is in all of our lives today, is precisely the kind of thing that ought to be the subject of debate from our nation's elected representatives. So that option certainly remains to the FCC. Another option that the FCC is reportedly considering is to go back on its interpretation of the 1996 Act and conclusion that internet service providers ought to be treated as information service providers, overturn that interpretation, and pursue ancillary jurisdiction or exercise of jurisdiction under Title II of the Act, treating internet service providers as common carriers. It seems to me that there are two issues that the FCC would have to work through there. The first is it would have to formally flip its interpretation, an interpretation which it reached after much consideration and thought all the way to the Supreme Court. And then it would have to provide a reasoned explanation for that interpretation. As the Supreme Court made clear just last term in another FCC case, FCC versus Fox, there's nothing that prevents an administrative agency from changing its position over time or even from one administration to the next. But when the agency does that, it still has to provide a reasoned explanation. So the FCC would have to provide that explanation. And then in defending it, it would have to deal with all the statements it had made earlier about why the exact opposite position was reasoned and made sense. And then the FCC would have to issue a new notice of proposed rulemaking, because it hasn't identified Title II as a source of authority for regulating broadband internet access yet. And so it would have to identify that, and then we would be basically back to where we were in October 2009 when the FCC issued its notice of proposed rulemaking that we're discussing today. And at that point, we'd have to think about whether or not it would make sense to examine this issue and write another paper. So I think I will stop there. Thank you very much.
The reason I'm sorry I talked over you before, but the reply comments are now due April 8th.
Oh, I misspoke. I'm sorry. You're right.
No, March 5th. So anyway, thank you all very much for being here, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I do think it's really important. I think it's important for people not to talk in an echo chamber. So thank you so much. And I want to say that Greg, I really enjoyed your paper. It looked a lot like Helgi's fantastic brief in the Comcast case. I remember when I first read Helgi's brief in the Comcast case, I was like, oh, man. I mean, if people don't know Helgi and the quality of her work, they should. I'm sorry. I love you. We don't agree on very much when it comes to substance, but I just think I agree with Brian. You're one of the best and smartest people out there, so you can blush. So I could stand up here today and use my time trying to defend the FCC's assertion of ancillary jurisdiction under sections 230B and 706. I could do that, but I'm not going to, because quite frankly, I think it's very weak. I'm also concerned about agencies grabbing too much with ancillary jurisdiction. My organization paid Steptoe & Johnson an awful lot of money to bring the American Library Association versus FCC case. That's a broadcast flag case, which I won't get into. So I agree with you, Greg, that agencies should not have unbounded power to adopt whatever rules they want. There has to be some sort of ancillary hook if you don't have a specific mandate. But we have to remember, this is what's really important. Your paper is all about net neutrality. We have to remember that this authority debate, this jurisdictional debate, is not just about net neutrality. It's about whether the FCC can protect broadband consumers at all. So let me tick off a couple of things that would be at risk if the FCC has no jurisdiction to regulate broadband internet access, okay? Not the internet, broadband internet access. That's a really important distinction, okay? We're not talking about regulating the content, applications, and services that make up the internet. We're talking about regulating the on-ramp to the internet. Very important distinction. Okay, so without the proper authority, the FCC can't change the Universal Service Fund to provide money for broadband rather than plain old telephone service. Second, it can't adopt truth in billing or transparency rules. Third, it can't protect broadband through public safety rules. Can't do anything about data roaming rights for wireless carriers. can't protect consumers from invasions of privacy over the broadband internet. And finally, can't do anything about disability access to the broadband internet. So everybody wants to bring it down to net neutrality because that's the most controversial things. But these things are a lot less controversial. But if the FCC doesn't have power at all to regulate broadband internet access, all those protections go right out the window. So that leaves us with two choices. First, we can find new sources of ancillary authority, or we can revisit, as Greg said, the 2002 FCC determination to classify broadband internet access services as information services. So let me talk about the first point a little. Justice Thomas, for whom Helgi clerked, in the Brandex case, made it really, really clear that classifying internet access as an information service did not remove power from the FCC to regulate internet access providers. So let me quote. So whereas information service providers are not subject to mandatory common carriage regulation under Title II, the Commission remains free to impose special regulatory duties on facilities-based ISPs under its Title I ancillary jurisdiction. So, in fact, it's kind of interesting. If people, you know, read the dockets in the National Broadband Plan and the net neutrality rulemaking, both the National Cable Telecommunications Association and AT&T have been tying themselves up in knots trying to find the right ancillary jurisdictional hook for the commission to use to redirect USF funds for broadband. All right, so, you know, so for some people, for some companies, getting that USF money is really, really important. But if you don't have any Title I authority and you're not going to go to Title II, you're out of luck. Now, I have a problem with continuing to throw the Title I spaghetti up against the wall to see if it sticks, because it's just an invitation for more litigation. It puts the network providers in the driver's seat, and it hurts edge innovators and consumers because they're left unprotected. So while you go running to Congress trying to get authority, consumers are screwed. I mean, let's face it, because the FCC can't do anything if, you know, somebody is reading their packets and, you know, or somebody is maybe, you know, blocking what they think is copyrighted bits, but they aren't. Where is the recourse for consumers? So I and my organization believes that the far better course is for the FCC to revisit its decision to classify broadband internet access services as information services. As Greg said, there's no higher burden. There's no, as the Fox case said, there's no higher burden. They just have to give a reasoned explanation. And if you read the Fox case closely, they don't actually have to show that their new decision is better than their old decision. They just have to give a reasoned explanation. It's no higher, no lower deference under Chevron for doing that. So I would argue that the FCC's predictive judgments in 2002 were wrong in three respects. So if we do have to go through that and show why you know, the old decision is wrong, there's three reasons. So the first reason the FCC gave for putting broadband internet access under information services was a sort of the notion that internet services and access services were integrally intertwined, all right? And that when an ISP was offering, okay, that's using the words of the Communications Act, when they were offering these services, you couldn't really differentiate between the two. Now, I don't think that's true anymore, okay? Yes, you may still get your email. You still may get the ability to make to build a website, but that's not what you're buying. You're buying 100 megabits per second. You're buying super speedy, fast internet service. That's what carriers are offering to the public. They're not offering email, and you can get email from anywhere, right? You can get Gmail, Hotmail, what have you. You don't need to have an ISP service to get those things. So I want to quote from Justice Scalia, and it's amazing. I'm going to quote from Justice Scalia twice. Okay, so pinch me, because I don't think I've ever done that before. And I'd urge you all to read the Brandex dissent. So on this integration point, despite the court's mighty labors to prove otherwise, the telecommunications component of cable modem service retains such ample independent identity that it must be regarded as being an offer, especially when seen from the perspective of the consumer or the end user, which the court purports to find determinative. The commission's ruling began by noting that cable, this is the 2002 ruling, that cable modem services provides both high-speed access to the internet and other applications and functions, because that is exactly how any reasonable consumer would perceive it, as consisting of two separate things. Okay, that was in 2005. This is internet time, folks. I would say that not only holds true, it held true then, it holds true even more now, because the offering of the applications and content really isn't integrally intertwined, and it's not really what you're being offered when you get Verizon Fios or Comcast or what have you. So that's number one, the one predictive judgment. The second, and this is big and we can argue about this, is that facilities-based competition would arise. And that would prevent some of the concerns that people had about non-discrimination. Well, we know that that's not happened. We have regional duopolies in most of the country. In 20% of the country, you have a choice of one broadband service provider. In 10% of the country, you don't have any choice at all. So I think it's very, very hard to argue that we have robust competition for internet access. And the third point, and this is critically important, is the FCC predicted that consumers would continue to be protected, all right? The FCC would always have the ability to protect it. Well, if Helgi wins her case and you know, we can't find other Title I ancillary authority, hey, consumers are not protected for all those things that I talked about. So let me close, again, by quoting my new favorite justice, Scalia. No, second favorite to Thomas, Scalia.
This is all on tape, Judy, by the way. I mean, just so you know.
It's all right. I'm going to get thrown out of the Liberals Club. After all is said and done, I'm quoting now, after all the regulatory cant has been translated and the smoke of agency expertise blown away, it remains perfectly clear that someone who sells cable modem services offering telecommunications. I hope that the FCC heeds Justice Scalia and reclassifies broadband internet access as a Title II service.
Thank you, Gigi.
I told Gigi, who is honestly my favorite member of the public interest community, that we have a big intellectual tent here at the Federalist Society. So I think she has proven herself to be a bona fide member of the Intellectual Diversity Club. We, of course, are litigating the case for Comcast that precipitated the agency's NPRM. I'll get to that story later. In Washington, there's always a story and a backstory. The litigation is the backstory to the proceeding that we're discussing here today. But first, I'd like to touch briefly on the options for the FCC's next step that Greg and Gigi touched on. Greg mentioned seeking legislation. They both mentioned Title II reclassification. Greg didn't mention, and Gigi touched on, and I'd like to suggest a third way. How about the proper, lawful use of ancillary authority? Even if the D.C. Circuit reaches the statutory authority in the Comcast appeal, which they may not, because Comcast actually urged decision of the case on a much narrower procedural ground, the most the D.C. Circuit could hold is that the agency erred in adopting the Comcast order. So you might imagine an opinion that said that Section 230 and 706, as Greg noted, are not appropriate bases for the exercise of ancillary authority because they're just policy statements. So the agency, even in that world, would still be free to do the hard work that is required to lawfully exercise ancillary authority. Nothing in the Comcast appeal or in any appeal of this NPRM would result in a judicial ruling that there is no FCC authority over the internet or even internet access. We all know what the Article III case and controversy limitations mean, and that means that any decision by a court is limited to that which is before it, that dispute. So again, there's a lot of panic in the streets over the need to go to Title II reclassification, but why couldn't the agency find the substantial evidence that was necessary to show that the exercise of ancillary authority was necessary to the execution of an actual statutory function? That will still be, I would imagine, permissible under the law. So you don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater and run to Title II. Again, novel concept in Washington for administrative agencies, but how about the lawful exercise of ancillary authority? That's a third way that's getting absolutely no attention in this debate. ancillary authority, of course, the judicial test for the lawful execution of that power is necessarily a fact-specific analysis, that second prong that Greg noted that really contains all the action here, looks at the particular rule that was adopted and the agency's explanation for the need to adopt that rule in order to execute some other function. So I would submit respectfully to Gigi that it's not clear that USF rules or data roaming rules or consumer protection rules would be off the table. If the agency can tie rules like that to a specific statutory mandate, some substantive part of the act, not a hortatory policy statement, make the record to show that it can't do its job under those provisions unless it regulates under its ancillary authority in this related area, that could well stand. So I think we ought not exaggerate kind of the debate. I know it's fun and it makes it sexier to talk about, but there are fact-specific analyses that would be undergone, and that's still a path for the agency to pursue. Brand X, of course, upheld the initial classification of internet services as information services. And of course, I love all Justice Thomas opinions. And because I love them so much, I read them very carefully. So while the quote that Gigi drew our attention to is in the opinion, the end of the opinion also says, we express no opinion on the exercise of ancillary authority that was teed up in the rulemaking there. And there was, of course, no ancillary authority question presented to the court in that case. It was only the reclassification question. So it's important to notice, to I think what Justice Thomas meant was agencies are free to try to exercise Title I ancillary authority, and we'll have to wait and see whether any future exercises of that authority would be upheld under the test in a particular case or controversy. So now to the backstory. We all in this panel know this, but not everybody in the room. The NPRM was precipitated by our litigation. In August of 2008, the FCC sanctioned Comcast for violating its internet policy statement. At the time, I felt like Alice going down the rabbit hole because everybody around me was talking about the enforcement of a policy statement. And the last time I had checked, a policy statement had the legal force and effect of law, the same legal force and effect as this sheet of paper that I just wrote my notes on. It's not law. It's not promulgated pursuant to the APA. It's nonsense to talk about violating a policy statement. That, in fact, is what we told the D.C. Circuit. And we urged the narrow resolution of the case on that ground, which would actually have no effect whatsoever on the NPRM. Not Gigi's group, Public Knowledge, but Free Press, the public interest group that brought the original complaint against Comcast, was the only party in the litigation that stood up in the Court of Appeals and urged the court to reach the statutory authority question. Both Comcast and the FCC asked for a narrower resolution. So if the court gets to that question, it will have been really at the urging of Free Press and certainly not of Comcast. On the same day that the FCC filed its brief in our case, it issued its NPRM. I don't think that was a coincidence. One of the things we had argued in our case was that the agency had acted improperly because, as I mentioned, they enforced a policy statement against us. No rule, no regulation, no agency precedent, no law, no nothing except for a policy statement. We think it was an inherent concession of that legal error, that the agency, at the same time it was defending its position in our case, rushed a notice of proposed rulemaking out the door to turn the policy statement into law and therefore to apply it to internet access providers on at least a prospective basis. It, of course, would not cure any problems as to Comcast because this is past conduct that occurred well before even the issuance of the NPRM. So it's often interesting to see what the competing motivations were. And while the NPRM looks kind of like interesting, you know, attempt to tackle this subject, I thought the group might be interested to know that it, in our humble opinion, was an attempt to cure, at least going forward, the really fundamental legal problems in the Comcast order and the sanctions that our client, at least, was subject to. So those are my parting thoughts here, adding to the wonderful comments of my colleagues. There is a third way here, the lawful exercise of ancillary authority. Yes, it requires hard work. Yes, it requires the building of a record, but that's what agencies, in my humble opinion, are supposed to do. And secondly, the backstory here is the Comcast litigation that really precipitated the NPRM. And my final point is that regardless of what happens in any of the proceedings, it is, I humbly submit, not accurate to say that all FCC authority over the internet will be gone. It will mean that particular rules fail to withstand judicial review under the fact-specific ancillary authority test. And other rules, like USF rules, if they could be properly tied to the right provision in the Communications Act, could well withstand judicial review. Thank you.
Thank you, Ogie. A brief response from you.
Yeah, it's very brief. I mean, I'm with you, Helgi. Let's, you know, I want to hear from your clients and others what those Title I bases are. Okay, it's not my preferred way of going because, to be quite honest with you, again, you want to keep going down the road of Title I, everybody's going to run back to court and we're going to be in the same position we are now. You may absolutely be right that all those things I ticked off have some jurisdictional hook somewhere. And it wouldn't be wrong for the commission to go down that road. But my fear is that in the meantime, there's an awful lot of regulatory uncertainty, particularly for consumers, about whether they're going to be protected or not. So the third way is an interesting way. It may be the way the FCC goes. But I do think that Title II is a firmer, you know, if you give a good reasoned explanation for why you're going back to the way it was for 75 years, you know, as long as they do that, they're on much firmer legal ground. I'm not going to argue with you on the procedural infirmities because, quite honestly, I agree with you. All right. I think public knowledge was on the complaint that Free Press bought. You know, I think we worked with the hand we were dealt. There was no reclassification, wasn't even on the table, right? We worked with the hand that we were dealt. We had somebody who wanted to file a complaint because, you know, your client was acting badly. Whether the case was resolved in the most sound procedural way, I have no opinion on that. But the third way is interesting. My concern, again, is that, you know, it leads you down the road of litigating every single jurisdictional hook where if you just go back to Title II, give it firm legal, you know, give a firm explanation that would survive Chevron deference. Remember, Brand X was a Chevron deference case. All right. And in fact, in the case of AT&T versus Portland, the court said the better reading is the reading that Justice Scalia gave it. So it could go either way, and I think it would be upheld in court.
Great. Thank you, Gigi. So let's talk a little bit about the proper ancillary jurisdictional test for rules. Greg talked about that the action is on the second half of the test, and that is whether the regulation is reasonably ancillary to the effective performance of the agency's mission. American Library and your paper discussed the test as being whether or not it's reasonably ancillary to the effective performance of its statutorily mandated responsibilities. But the commission, in its brief in the Comcast case, argued that its regulations are reasonably ancillary to the effective performance of its objectives or regulatory goals, citing Midwest Video, or United Video case, which argued that it was the protection and promotion of a valid communications policy goal. So different permutations on whether or not the policies stated in 230 and 706 are sufficient to satisfy the ancillary jurisdiction test. Presumably, if its goals and objectives, 230 and 706 are appropriate bases for that. If it is a mandated responsibility, then presumably they're far weaker. So which is the proper test?
I think the test that we stated in our paper is the proper test. I think you can imagine why the FCC would rather have the test be focused on objectives and policies as opposed to statutorily mandated responsibilities, because those are the sorts of things that the FCC is left pointing to. And I do think that it also has to be statutorily mandated responsibilities, because what we're talking about here is, you know, one rule saying that agencies can only act pursuant to their delegated authority, and another rule being, yeah, that's true, but there's some ancillary jurisdiction out there too. Well, it seems to me the only way for the ancillary jurisdiction doctrine to have a really solid grounding is to get back to the statutorily mandated responsibilities. And I think Helgi put it a nice way when she talked about, look, here's a statutory responsibility we do have. In order to carry out that statutorily mandated responsibility, we have to pass this other rule. And it seems to me that that is much more easily defended as an appropriate exercise of agency authority, even if there's not an explicit statutory basis for that particular exercise.
Well, the presidential answer to Brian's question is that binding D.C. Circuit precedent, which is based on Supreme Court cases that came down after Midwest Video 1, state it explicitly as a statutorily mandated responsibility that has to be pointed to under the second prong.
And 230 and presumably 230 and 706 don't pass that test in your view, of course.
No, they don't.
Well, you have a particular problem with 230 is because, as Greg's paper points out and Helgi's brief points out, there's actually language that goes against them exercising authority, saying that, you know, the internet should be unregulated, unfettered by regulation. Now, again, I would argue it's not internet. This is why I started off saying the grounds on which they, you know, on which the FCC puts its, you know, ancillary hooks, it's just not strong. Okay, we can argue about whether it's, you know, a policy would suffice. The FCC certainly argued that, but it's still not strong. And I do have concerns. I'm particularly concerned when it comes to the content arena, that if the FCC has unfettered power under its ancillary jurisdiction, that it's going to start mandating that ISPs or opening the door wide to ISPs filtering content for copyright infringement, that it's going to get into preserving certain business models for journalism. I mean, so unbounded discretion is not good, and I'd prefer to keep it narrow.
And does your preference for narrowness also extend to, for example, if they try to do universal service under Title I, you would argue that it may or may not work? Or if
that's
they try,
right.
You would may or may not support it, or you believe it would withstand scrutiny?
I just think that everything that people want to do to protect consumers, to promote adoption, to promote deployment under Title I is at risk. Okay, yes, you're right. The Comcast decision isn't probably going to wipe away Title I authority, period. It's going to take although the FCC had, what, about 7 or 8 jurisdictional hooks that it cited in its Comcast decision. But everything where the FCC might want to protect consumers or promote adoption or deployment is at risk if they do not have Title I authority.
And why is it, Helgi, from your perspective, why is it better to go back and do this pursuant to Title I than go to Title II?
Well, first I should say that in that regard, I'm just expressing my personal opinion. We are obviously counsel for Comcast, and my reiteration of our litigation positions is, of course, tied to my client's position. But the flourishes here today are mine alone. And the flourish that has occurred to me is that there is going to be a lawful path for the agency to pursue, regardless of what happens in any of these other proceedings, and then that's being entirely overlooked in this debate. So I'm not saying that that is necessarily a better approach than some other approach. Perhaps it is wiser to seek legislation, as Greg pointed out. The agency would then certainly not have any vulnerabilities on its authority that would satisfy Gigi's interest in taking care of authority in one fell swoop and not litigating authority on a case-by-case basis. So I actually don't have any opinion on what's better. I just felt that it was important that this other way, the legal use of ancillary authority, was being overlooked in the discussion. We're either running to Title II reclassification, which would overturn a huge amount of agency precedent, or we are seeking legislation, which in some folks' eyes has its downside because it would take time to accomplish that. So it just amuses me often that sometimes the lawful exercise of a particular power is of and often overlooked in these debates.
Gigi,
what about
Brian,
this?
Can I just promote? Yeah. I just want to promote. Kevin Warbeck has a article on some of these questions and does promote a third way. It's called Off the Hook. You can get it at SSRC. We also promoted a third way to try to tie ancillary jurisdiction to the sort of the telecommunications component, which to me is the same thing as saying Title II, but it's in our net neutrality comments as well. I don't want to get into a great deal of detail because I do think there's like a sliver of difference between tying, you know, ancillary jurisdiction to the transport component and going back to Title II, which is Title II is just neater and firmer, and that's, you know, why we're supporting it.
Well, and actually on that front, that was going to be my question. It's neater and firmer than Title I and ancillary jurisdiction to do Title II. Isn't it neatest and firmest to go back to the Congress and get it all cleared up that way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sure, it would be better. There's no doubt about it. You know, but Congress can't even get its, like, most important appointees appointed right now. Okay, and in the meantime, while they're doing health care and climate change and trying to get people appointed to the judiciary and to key, like, public safety and homeland security positions in Congress, consumers are left unprotected. This one will fall down the – yeah, it's obviously the better route. Is it a realistic route? Probably not, just because there are so many unbelievably – and not that this isn't important, all right, but this isn't health care, and it isn't, like, saving the financial system. It isn't a lot about – making sure that our judiciary and our key public safety and homeland security agencies are well staffed.
Are we on that one, Gregor?
I think there's a reason why the FCC hasn't gone back to Congress. It must feel it won't get what it would ask for, and whether that's because of other legislative priorities or because there's not a majority that wants to give the FCC more authority in this area, which would likely lead to more regulation, I don't know. I mean, the one thing that I would say is I think that there is a benefit to having certainty here. I mean, when there's not certainty, what you have is the chill of the threat of enforcement against the companies that are providing these internet access services. So the one thing that seems to me very problematic about where we are now is we're having this debate today where, you know, virtually all of us concede or admit or acknowledge that there is very little, if anything, to the FCC's exercise of ancillary jurisdiction under Title I, that at a minimum it's tenuous. There's debate about Title II, but yet the FCC hasn't publicly put the focus on Title II, so we don't know where that is. And then, you know, Helgi raises the interesting third option of just kind of the piecemeal approach. But the one thing that seems to me that's missing that everyone suffers from is a lack of certainty.
Under Title I, the Commission in its brief in the Comcast case argues that Title I grants it standalone authority and cites Southwestern Cable as Title I imposes responsibilities on the Commission that the agency is required to fulfill, cites to a CCIA case, Rural Telephone TTE, and distinguishes the cases that you relied on your brief. You want to talk a little bit about the role of Title I as a standalone grant of authority to the Commission?
Well, I mean, Title I, I think, is the – for those who aren't avid readers of the Communications Act, Title I
First
says –
First of all, congratulations.
Yeah.
I have a copy if anybody wants to peruse it.
It just says that we hereby create the Federal Communications Commission for the purpose of regulating – you know, the nation's radio waves, and for the fast, efficient, and wonderful distribution of information in America, your Congress. That's the provision we're talking about here. And the FCC has relied on that as the substantive source of authority pursuant to which it could adopt ancillary authority rules. So without wanting to waste everybody's time, I mean, that argument is even weaker than Section 230 and 706, which my intellectually honest friend to my right, or should I say left, Gigi has already acknowledged. So that's even weaker than 230 and 706. But one thing I wanted to briefly touch on, because I thought it might be of interest to this group and is important, is what the regulatory agenda of some of those who are promoting Title II reclassification really is. Now, I think there are folks who are seeking legal certainty for their legislative and regulatory goals, and that's one thing. But a man named Robert McChesney, who founded the public interest group Free Press, who brought the enforcement complaint against Comcast, has said in an interview with an internet publication called The Socialist Project – that, quote, what we want to have in the U.S. and in every society is an internet that is not private property but a public utility. Our struggle is to make the internet into a public utility. Well, internet broadband networks, of course, are currently private property. And for some, the Title II reclassification debate is really an agenda to transform that private property into public property. That's why takings issues are now popping up in the regulatory proceeding on the NPRM. So I don't want to be hysterical about this, but those who are pushing Title II have openly said that their goal is to take this private property and turn it into public property, because only then can it be safe for all Americans to use.
Okay, I got to defend my colleagues at Free Press. We don't always agree on everything, but, I mean, this is just kind of red baiting. I mean, Robert McChesney doesn't. I mean,
right,
I know, but he doesn't make the policy rules for Free Press. I mean, Reed Hundt is on my board. Do you think that everything that Reed Hundt ever said you could ascribe to public knowledge? That would be a pretty scary thought. And I love Reed Hundt. Let me get on the private property meme, because telephone companies and cable companies dig up rights of way. They use, you know, public pole attachments. They use spectrum licensed by the government that belongs to the public. There's no private property here. Okay, this is not. I mean, if you want to make a takings argument, be my guest. I think you
don't think Comcast owns its pipe.
They own its pipe, but they don't. You know what? If they didn't have the rights of way, if they didn't get rights of way. Permission to use the rights of way from the localities, they'd have a pipe. That's what they would have. They would not have an internet service. They would not have a cable service. Your client and AT&T and Verizon and others cannot survive without permission from public entities, from taxpayer-supported entities. And, you know, just to say this is private property like a car or a house, it's not supported by the law. It's not supported by reality because, yes, it's their coaxial cable, but they don't have a business unless some government gives them permission. Same thing with the airwaves. The FCC licenses the airwaves. There would be no wireless industry, and there almost wasn't a wireless industry, without the FCC say-so. That's not private property. That's a license.
Preview of debates to come.
Exactly. A lot of it was made in Greg's paper, and we've talked about it a little bit here, about ancillary authority can't be exercised in a way that's otherwise inconsistent with the statute. And most commonly, the non-discrimination requirement is invoked among the six principles as being inconsistent with the rest of the statutory scheme, particularly as a pure non-discrimination mandate, which is the current draft, because it is a heightened standard even from Title II. What about the other five principles? Are those similarly inconsistent with the statute? Is there some subset of net neutralities, the proposed six net neutrality rules, that could pass the not inconsistent, otherwise inconsistent with the statute test?
I mean, I haven't gone through and checked off each one. I mean, the one thing that I would say is, as I view it, the inconsistency with the statute is sort of the cherry on the top, or the nail in the coffin, depending on where you are in the policy debate. There are other fundamental problems with ancillary jurisdiction, the exercise of ancillary jurisdiction, before you even get there.
I mean, again, a lot of it depends on whether you consider this regulating the internet or regulating internet access. Okay, if you consider it regulating internet, there are certainly things in the statute that would appear to be inconsistent. But I think, you know, you asked, Brian, one of your questions is what's the single biggest misconception of your opponents? And while I had a list of about six of them, I think the biggest one is net neutrality would regulate the internet. Net neutrality is very narrow, okay? It governs the relationship between the customer and the ISP, and the bottleneck control that the ISP has and market power that it has in a world of high switching costs, information asymmetry, other barriers to entry. So I think it's really, really important for people to recognize, and this is where it drives me crazy when people say, well, what about what Google is doing and Akamai and, you know, this and that and Bob McChesney about what? You know, let's regulate what they're doing. And I find that incredibly ironic that the same people that don't like net neutrality regulation would then want to apply regulation to all the application content and services that make up the internet. Net neutrality is about networks. It's not about Google. It's not about Akamai. Helgi, sorry if I just took out like three of your questions.
Yeah, that was wrong. Helgi,
entertaining.
Is there a right way that you could exercise answer authority to get to the other five principles, putting aside discrimination?
If I were the general counsel of the FCC, which I am not, I could possibly take a crack at finding some substantive provision. I'd have to flip through the whole act. I'd have to build a record, and I'd have to do that boring, drudgery, administrative law work that, you know, frankly is what's required, but is not a ton of fun. So I can't answer your question one way or the other, but it seems to me it's certainly theoretically possible.
Okay, we're going to open it up to some audience questions. I'm going to ask one more, and then we'll open it up. First Amendment issues, Kyle McSlero had a speech where he touched on some of the First Amendment concerns associated with net neutrality regulation. Are those concerns well-founded? Which way do they cut? I think the folks have used the First Amendment on both sides of this debate. Who has the better side of that argument? Gigi loves the First Amendment.
Well, I mean, look, even if you consider ISP speakers, which I don't, I mean, what do ISPs have to say? Okay, and how is this? Nobody is saying they can't. They can carry whatever they want. We're just saying you can't degrade or block other people's speech. And I think that's the most important point, is that, you know, in areas of media, the Turner case and other cases, it's all been about balancing the interests of speakers, of the corporate speaker, okay, I'm not ready to concede their speakers, and the public, all right? And the Supreme Court has upheld and other courts have upheld restrictions, for example, restriction on ILEX doing electronic publishing, all right, in order to promote speech, in order to limit market power. So, again, it's the same feeling I have with regard to the takings clause. It's just like, I'll see you in court. I just don't see any precedent that would support saying that citizens don't have any rights vis-a-vis an ISP as far as the First Amendment is concerned. It's always been a balance of rights between the citizen and the media speaker.
I mean, I guess the one thing I would say on that is, and I think Gigi is right, you don't want to overgeneralize in terms of what it is at issue here, but I think courts, and if it got to it, the Supreme Court would be very concerned about the regulation of a forum, public forum like the internet, and would be take very seriously First Amendment issues. And the other thing I would say is that in terms of the exercise of ancillary jurisdiction or whatever jurisdiction they are propounding, I think the constitutional issues could come into play, because any doubt that those issues create, I think, is going to further undermine the FCC's case for exercising jurisdiction in a court's eyes.
Can I make one other point? Because if net neutrality is a First Amendment issue, I think again, those that, you know, it's interesting that Kyle would, you know, make this argument, because if that argument would win for net neutrality, it certainly would win for interconnection, right? I mean, wouldn't it also be for speech to make Link's company, Link has left, Link's company interconnect with Comcast VoIP service?
Well, may I defend Mr. McSlero for just one moment?
I like Kyle, by the way. No, it's not personal.
No, I know it's not. He was responding to something in the notice of proposed rulemaking that suggested that the First Amendment could be an affirmative basis for adopting net neutrality regulations. His point was, and I think this is pretty indisputable if you refresh your recollection of the text of the First Amendment and where exactly in the Constitution it appears in the Bill of Rights, that the First Amendment is a limitation on government. It protects people from the government. It does not empower the government to regulate. It's not an affirmative source of authority to adopt regulation. So the context of his comment, I think, is important. I think First Amendment questions are implicated in the proceeding. That's a different matter. But his point was, we shouldn't be using the First Amendment as a basis for regulation. First Amendment protects people. It does not empower the government to regulate.
With that, Barbara Espin looks like she has a question in the back.
Barbara Espin, Progress and Freedom Foundation. I have I don't know if it's a theoretical or a philosophical question that either Greg or Helgi or Gigi could answer, I hope. And that is, on reclassification of broadband internet access service as something else, the common carriage, is that action a policy action on the part of the FCC? In other words, is that a policy change that they can make if they can justify it on an adequate record? Or would it be more akin to an involuntary imposition of common carrier status on a non-common carrier? I think the answer could be different depending on how that action is viewed, and I'd be interested in your thought.
I mean, to me, it's an interpretation of its organic statute. I mean, that to me is that a policy decision? I don't know, but that's, you know, the FCC interprets the Communications Act. That's what it does, and as long as it gives under Chevron, gives a reasoned decision for doing so, the courts will uphold it. If it doesn't, if it does things in the slapdash way, as some have accused the previous FCC of doing, then it will be overturned.
Well, I mean, I guess just to follow up on that just briefly, I mean, I do think that if you're the entities that is being labeled a common carrier and then suddenly subject to all these additional regulations, I mean, you're much more likely to view it as in the latter box than the former box, and that does raise legal issues and potentially takings issues. But, I mean, I think Gigi's right that ultimately it's going to get back to whether the agency's interpretation can be defended.
We got a question from Scott Cleland over here in the corner.
Yes, Scott Cleland at Competition, and I have a question about competition.
We're hoping to get you a microphone here, Scott. I apologize. We want to make sure you get fully captured in the record of the today's
proceedings. At Competition, have a question on competition. And, Gigi, you mentioned that if the FCC was going to go back, one of the prongs they would have to say is they'd have to have a reasoned explanation that there isn't competition, that it didn't work. My question is a simple one, is when the court, if they got that coming back to them, wouldn't they have to define what competition is, and would they define competition for the first time in the context of the 96 Act, which promoted competition, or would they look to some other thing like antitrust? Because my question is the 96 Act was ending a monopoly policy and promoting competition, and I think it's indisputable that competition, or it's indisputable, it's no longer a monopoly. And so the question simply is, on what legal basis and how would the court, appeals court, define competition?
Well, again, the question before a court would be, was the FCC's judgment reasonable? Okay, so it's not up to the court to define competition, although some of the D.C. Circuit might feel otherwise. It's just that the FCC would have to give a reasonable definition of competition. I don't think this FCC would define competition as more than one, as two, as opposed to one. Yes, we're not in a monopoly world. We're in a duopoly world, although we are in a termination monopoly world, which we don't talk about. So let me talk about it for a minute. So I sell Gigi water, okay, and I've got a website that I want everybody to see, but my ISP, Brian's ISP, which is, we'll call AT&T for now, okay? They have a favorable deal, because I don't think there's any AT&T representatives in the room. They have a favorable deal with Fiji Water, okay? Well, if I want Brian to buy Gigi Water, I'm screwed, okay? Because Fiji Water's website comes up a lot faster than Gigi Water's website. So there is a monopoly problem here. It's not, you know, it's not the facilities-based monopoly, that we have facilities-based duopoly, but we still have a termination monopoly. And I would think that the FCC would consider that termination monopoly in making any decision about whether there's competition or not.
Indeed, that was part of the NPRM, as I recall. Yep. Additional questions? Yes.
Two questions, perhaps quick ones. First, would it be the FCC's position that they have taken the third way? In other words, that the NPRM is, in fact, without, you know, prescinding from whether or not it is satisfactory or not, would it be their position that, yes, they did follow the third way in the NPRM? First question. And the second one is also on competition, but competition between agencies. Does anybody see a role, or how would you characterize the proper responsibilities of the Federal Trade Commission here with regard to the Internet? They certainly have gotten involved in behavioral advertising and other issues that certainly trench on Internet questions and possible FCC authority.
I can answer the first question. I would think, if there's any FCC people in the room, they can stand up. But I would think the answer to that is no, because in the NPRM, they relied on the same policy provisions, 230 and 706, that they relied on in the Comcast order that's currently the subject of the appeal. So if the D.C. Circuit says, policy provisions are not statutorily mandated responsibilities. You have to have a substantive regulatory provision of the act that you're relying on. They would have to redo. So the NPRM did not attempt to do that.
I thought it was slightly broader than what they relied on the Comcast.
They threw in a couple other things, but it wasn't terribly serious.
I think
serious.
They would argue they've done it the correct way, I guess.
Yeah. Would you? Yeah. Okay. Well,
I think they would argue that they've
done it. I agree that they haven't done the hard work. I mean, this is, see, one of the things what we're actually really asking for is for the FCC to do such a proceeding. All right. I mean, look, the FCC can't turn a dime tomorrow and reclassify. All right. They can't do that. But we're saying, look, you can't have this national broadband plan of 500 pages and not say we have to make sure we have the authority to do this. Okay, so we're not asking them within the national broadband plan to decide the reclassification / authority question. That would be really poor agency decision making. But what we're saying is, you know, soon thereafter, you've got to tee it up. Because if the Comcast case comes out and with a decision on authority as opposed to procedure, you've got a national broadband plan that's worthless. Okay, so at some point, you're going to have to do that hard work, whether it's reclassifying or finding the ancillary authority and doing the hard work. Can I just answer the FTC? So the FTC's mandate is narrow, okay? It goes after unfair and deceptive trade practices, all right? Now, if Comcast is blocking my bits, that's not necessarily an unfair and deceptive trade practice. Okay? And there is a difference, and it may not also rise to an antitrust violation. So, because somebody the other day, I was in San Francisco giving a speech, and she said, well, why can't you bring a complaint to the Justice Department? Number one, individuals, you know, just can't bring complaints. But, you know, what Comcast was doing, I really disagreed with the Martin FCC's decision saying that Comcast was blocking BitTorrent as a competitive matter. I wasn't convinced of that at all. And I'm not sure, you know, that they were trying to favor their video a service, and that's why they blocked BitTorrent. So I'm not so sure that would have arisen to a level where the antitrust authorities or the FTC could take care of it. The FCC does have public interest authority, and it's a little bit broader.
So, Gigi, isn't one perverse outcome of the return to Title II that you'd put broadband services back under the common carrier exemption and take the FTC cops sort of off the beat for
yes,
these issues?
Yes, that is perverse, and I think the common carrier exemption should be repealed.
And do you think the FTC?
I mean, just try to be consistent.
And the FTC obviously has responsibility for the rest of the economy. Do you just feel like it's not adequate for this portion of the economy? I mean, you seem to suggest that their unfair and deceptive practices test is not sufficient to protect the public.
Mm-hmm.
And you just think the public is generally not well protected.
No, not without some clearer authority for the FCC to take care of it.
I'm Aaron Reynolds, and I have a six-sentence argument that I'd like to present to Helgi and anybody on the panel. First, we at the Federalist Society respect what endures and is sound. Second, regulation that survives and endures is more principle-based than rule-based. Third, policy statements are what I take to be principle-based. Fourth, statutes and regulations are what I take to be rule-based. Five, rules get nibbled away by loopholes and judicial rulings. Number six is the question, should we do more to make policy statements enforceable?
The way to make a policy statement enforceable is to follow the procedural requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act for turning a policy statement, which is essentially an aspirational document, into something that has the force and effect of law. Policy statements have a very useful function when they are providing guidance on an existing legal duty, which can be embodied in any number of ways, a rule, an agency precedent, or even a federal statute. They're helpful because they give regulated entities some guidance and some clarity on what's expected of them. But a policy statement standing alone is not enforceable, and the APA requires that agencies follow a certain procedure, notice and comment, before they can be treated as law. It's a pretty simple proposition, and we hope the D.C. Circuit agrees.
Additional questions, Seth?
Gigi mentioned the broadband plan, which I believe is the Commission's response to a statutory obligation from about a year ago. So my question goes to the commission and its underlying statutory authority, what part of the statutes of the United States allow the commission to say, we're coming to Congress to ask for the following law? It would seem to me that it would be the Congress that says, we tell you where to work or what to work on, and you may tell us whether you have authority to do such and such, but you shouldn't be asking. I would think the chairman up on the Hill would be very nervous about this type of activity.
Someone in the room can check me on this, but I believe the National Broadband Plan mandate included requests for statutory changes. I think most chairmen have read the obligations of the commission is to respond to Congress if they're asked for legislative suggestions, but not to gratuitously go and sort of suggest things and lobby them. I don't know if anyone has a different view.
No, I think it's normal for agencies, if they don't feel that they have the ability to do something, to ask Congress to give them the ability or to give somebody else the ability. A lot of what the National Broadband Plan, my understanding, is going to be about is how broadband promotes things like, you know, energy savings and health care and education. So, you know, this massive process that's been going on for the last 6 to 8 months has involved, like, the Departments of Energy and Education and Health and Human Services. So it may not, the FCC may not just be asking Congress to give it the ability to do things. It may be asking it to give other agencies the ability. I'm fairly certain there's a copyright question in there where they're going to make recommendations for changing copyright law, actually in a way that I like, even though I'm generally uncomfortable with the FCC making recommendations with copyright, even if it's in a way I like.
If the FCC were part of the executive branch that were responsive to the president, then the necessary and expedient clause of Article 2 of the Constitution would certainly authorize it to recommend measures to Congress. Since they occupy a netherland, kind of presumptively independent of the president, I'm not sure whether they can invoke that provision in Article 2, but it's certainly normal that they would recommend measures to Congress.
Another question or two before we wrap up?
Oh, we have a statement called "Whose Ox Is Being Gored?" And I've heard the libraries, but I don't know if they were in that context of this. I've heard Comcast. I'm assuming this is a dollars issue. It's not a cultural war issue or anything like that. But so who are you representing?
I'm not sure it's so much. It is a dollars issue to some extent. To the extent, I think, and I don't want to speak for the carriers, they're here in the room, is a lot of the carriers see the oodles and oodles and oodles of money that Google makes and they want part of it. All right, so in that way, it is a dollars and cents issue. But a lot of it is just a control issue. All right, cable is used to controlling, you know, all the channels on its system and deciding what position they get, with the exception of broadcast stations, of course, and whether they get on the digital tier and so on and so forth. So it's kind of a, you know, being used to what you know, and there's a huge advantage if you're a carrier to actually have control. Carriers don't like to cede control, just like content providers don't like to cede control. So I think some of it is just, this has been our business model forever, and also seeing the edge providers making all this money, I think carriers want a piece of the pie. You know, you're using my pipes, and we can argue whether they're really your pipes or not, so why aren't you paying me?
I mean, I think Gigi's right that internet access providers who invest and put tremendous amounts of capital into building these networks, which I do believe they own, would like to retain control of that. Would you like it if the government told you that they wanted to park somebody else's car in your garage? Well, I don't think so. So it's not just about dollars. And it's also about, and we are here, you know, at a Federalist Society panel, it's about the proper limits of administrative law and what agencies can do when they go off and sanction a private company for violating something that literally was not law. So there is a higher principle here, and it's whether agencies can go out and regulate important sectors of the American economy when, in a democratic system, Congress has not apparently given them any authority to do that. So I think that is an important legal principle that's at stake here.
Yeah, I'm not here representing anyone. I'm come at it from more from the academic perspective that Helgi just mentioned. I mean, I do think that from the internet service provider's perspective, they're trying to provide the best services possible, the most efficient services, the services that people want. And to the extent that they feel that federal regulation, however well-intentioned, is preventing them from doing that. They're concerned about it, and I think they would be particularly concerned to be put into a completely different box that would subject them to much more regulation.
Now, since Gigi's been outnumbered, I'll let her go last on our closing question here.
Outnumbered, but not outmanned.
Indeed. What's the biggest threat to the future of the internet, Greg?
Boy.
It's a nice small question.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, the one thing that I guess I can say is that it's worked pretty well up to this point. I mean, I can't think of a few more explosive phenomenons during our lifetime. So, you know, it, as an invention, it's worked pretty well. So I'm not sure that we should necessarily be looking for a fix to anything.
I think it's, you know, unnecessary government regulation that stifles the investment and the tremendous innovation that we've seen since the origins of the internet. And Title II reclassification would be a step backwards in that regard.
So I think that the biggest threat to the future of the internet is that this fantastic democratic medium, this user-controlled, decentralized, innovation without permission network that distinguishes itself from all the top-down, you know, command and control broadcasting and cable casting will be replaced with a top-down centralized system that has, you know, limited access to innovators, limited access to creators. I think that's the greatest threat, is that regardless of whose ox is being gored, the internet was built to be user-controlled, to allow anyone to speak, not to be controlled by the providers of the on-ramp. And if we don't preserve that, then the internet will cease to be the internet that we know and love, and which has really changed the world in so many ways.
Great. With those final words, a round of applause for our great panel. Thank you all.